Hello and welcome to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson, a podcast for those seeking the ultimate in wine, food, and travel. Each week, she interviews winemakers, chefs, celebrities, and a variety of guests that shape the way we enjoy life.
Is Romani Conti, and I didn't even ask which vineyard it was it Romani Conti, was it Latage, was it Rijsberg Echezo that you tried? Was it a 78 Romani Conti?
It was Romani Conti.
Romani Conti, okay. Yeah. So to this day, with all of the experience you've had since, is that the wine that you would say was seminal, that turned your mind and was unsurpassed? Is that your true statement?
So far, yes. Still, okay. To this day, the most memorable experience with any single wine. Is it the best wine that I've ever had? It's the most memorable, the most life-changing. I was young. I was 22 years old, 22 and a half, almost 23 years old. And that impression, I don't think will ever be surpassed by a wine, just because it's kind of like the older you get, the more days and time you have diluting your experiences. You've experienced so many wonderful things. I was so young and I was so inspired by wine, and then to taste a wine at that level. And I had read the book about Domaine Romani Conti. I mean, this vineyard has been in grapes for probably 3,000 years. It's been in Pinot Noir cultivation, and it's been revered by kings taking the entire production for themselves. It's been fought over. It's been owned by, you know, counts, and it's just got so much history and legacy. But then it also has been understood and cultivated with love and passion for many, many years. It is a special place, but it has been cared for by special people as well. And
do you think there's a transference, like a cumulative effort that went into, and the human intent, in addition to the land itself, that special plot of land? And do you think it can be replicated, meaning that is it possible to create that type of phenomena, given, you know, maybe not thousands of years, but let's call it hundreds, with equal or compatible degree of intent in another geographical location, such as Sonoma County?
You will create, I think it is possible to create other wines that are at that level. You will never replicate Romani Conti anywhere else in the world, and I don't think anybody's trying to, or if they are, they're strongly mistaken that it's impossible. But can we create a wine that passes an experience to people that is relative to the experience that I had?
That level of quality and the theory of quality.
Complexity. And yeah. I think that there are sites that might be possible. I think that there are climates that Pinot Noir can thrive in, and soils that it can thrive in other parts of the world. And I wouldn't be making Chardonnay and Pinot Noir in the Sonoma Coast if I didn't feel it had potential for that. Romani Conti doesn't bottle a Romani Conti bottling from vines that are less than 45 years old. My vines are 20 years old at this point. So, you know, I've got 25 more years before I can even consider my vines at a point that they could even contribute that. So I do think it's a generational project. I do, and I'll be very honest, I do hope that my children have been inspired by what their parents have done and continue what we've started. You know, we've put a lot together, we've built a lot, we've worked very hard, but I think if they do have interest in wine, they're the ones that may actually see some of the benefits to the philosophy of when you only harvest 1 pound of Pinot Noir on a single grapevine each year, that vine can provide you 1 pound of Pinot Noir for 100 years or more. And you know, they may be able to see some very special things coming that I'll never see in my lifetime from the vineyards that we've planted. So they may not. Well, you know, it's up for them. It's for them to tell that story if that's what they so choose. But I definitely hope that they, at least it's the way I've designed small vines and why I don't have a big marketing budget and I only make 3,000 cases of wine. It's because I've really worked hard to not take on equity partners and keep this as a family business. And I am more of a farmer or a vigneron than anything else. So I'm growing very slowly and making sure that my craft speaks more strongly than my marketing speak. That is the number one thing that people know me for, is that my craftsmanship speaks for what I'm trying to do. When I talk about the style of wine that I want, a wine that can age but is enjoyable when it's released, all of those things that people say, wow, he's a phenomenal craftsman and a great farmer and he's a steward of the land, and those are more important to me than whether I get 96 points in a review, which it is nice when you think you make a great wine and somebody else thinks you make a great wine and gives you a relative score for that. Those are, you know, those are very nice things. I don't see them as the success to my brand. It's not what I'm hanging my coat on, but it is, you know, a nice thing to see that other people see the quality to what you're putting together as well. So
it is not the easiest by far path that you chose, particularly given the current circumstances where there's so much saturation in every category with respect to fine wines, and there's so much marketing speak. It has to be at least somewhat unsettling that your voice, which clearly is authentic, we learn now, will get drowned in the sea of voices that have a variety of motivations. What keeps you focused? Why are you so singularly minded about that?
Oh, that is a fun question. You know, I didn't know going into this that what my wife and I were creating was one of the most unique wineries in the state of California. I didn't do it for uniqueness. I did it because I thought it would make better wine. Mm-hmm. I planted 3,630 vines per acre when most people were planting 1,089 vines per acre because I thought it was going to make better wine. It was going to give me the style of wine that I wanted to be associated with. So I've never wavered from that. In 1998, I planted my first vineyard. I then have planted 40 plus vineyards on the Sonoma Coast over the past 20 years. And I think what we're doing is very unique. Most growers say, I don't want to import tractors from Burgundy, and there's no tractors in the US to farm a 4-foot tractor row, so I'm going to plant a 6-foot tractor row. And they build vineyards around tractors. And I said, I think this is going to make the best wine, and I'm going to go to France and to Italy and to Switzerland, and I'm going to find the best piece of equipment to import for the terrain that we have here on the Sonoma Coast. And I'm going to adapt that equipment to my vineyards and serviceability here in the US. And I'm going to farm the spacing I think is best for wine quality in California. Rather than building a vineyard around a tractor, I built the vineyard I wanted, and I went out and found a tractor to farm it. So we are a very rare species. We're not the only person that has planted high density in California by any stretch of the means. There are quite a few people that have dabbled in it. We are the only winery that I'm aware of that's 100% from high density vineyards and has specialized in figuring out the soil science, the rootstock science, the amount of sun exposure to balance the wines and give us the proper pH and so that we have less to do as cellar workers to the fruit that we're growing. And to me, that is very unique. So when I have the opportunity to share the dedication, the commitment, the amount of research that I have put into what I am doing with people, most people are fairly astounded that that we're doing that and that the wines are reflective of the intention of why we planted our vineyards that way. So yes, there is a lot of marketing speak. There's a lot going on in the wine culture in California. It's fun to see wine exploding in California. I'm a firm believer that a rising tide floats all ships. And I appreciate a lot of different styles of wine. So I'm not here standing on a soapbox saying somebody is doing something wrong and I'm doing something right. I am looking to make Chardonnay and Pinot Noir in a very specific style, and I think that the way I have chosen to plant my vineyards and cultivate using Grand Cru standards is a commitment to excellence that I see very few people willing to do in this area, but it gives me a very specific wine that is exactly what I'm looking for, and I love drinking my wines. I drink a lot of other wines. Every time I buy a bottle of wine at a restaurant, it's Old World. I'm drinking champagne or French Burgundy or Italian wines or wines from all over the world. I want to keep my mind open to what's out there. But at home, I enjoy the wines that I produce and I drink my wines regularly. And I'm very proud of that because I love the wines that I'm producing. I see them as on a playing field of the best wines of Pinot Noir and Chardonnay around the world, they're on that playing field. And I'm very proud of that. And I enjoy what I'm producing from where I'm producing it. So it's very, very rewarding from that standpoint. So, and if I don't sell out of it, at least I have great wine to drink, right?
So. Yes, tasting your wines over the years, I absolutely second that opinion. And it's just so fascinating to me that given your experience in the context that you described, which is being exposed to this, you know, gems, probably some of the most powerful examples of what wine could become, and then going after it on your own. I mean, there has to have been exhaustive research, like you described, establishing dialogue with other producers, with other mentors. But it had to have been pretty scary to put that first line in the ground.
It was very scary. You know, I went through the viticulture program at the Santa Rosa Junior College with Rich Thomas. Learned a tremendous amount. I studied plant science and soil science and viticultural practices. And I worked for Warren Dutton, one of the, you know, best growers in the area. And, you know, to start planting a vineyard when all you have is a good pair of work boots, a shovel, and a pickup truck, no, not a penny to your name, a starving college student, and to have somebody believe in you, to plant a vineyard for them and spend their money with you being the very first vineyard and have it be this philosophy of much higher density planting, it was scary. It was very scary to say, yes, I can do this. I can follow this vineyard from bringing a bulldozer onto your property and ripping the soil and removing bushes and building deer fences, and but it was so rewarding to plant them and see them grow and then harvest the grapes. And at first I harvested the grapes and delivered them to other wineries. I didn't have the money to make wine. So 1998 was my first vineyard I planted. 2005 was the first year I had saved enough money to make 3 barrels of wine. I made 75 cases of wine in 2005. And I went back to John Ash & Company and I sold a case of wine to John Ash & Company. That was my very first restaurant wine placement. And then I contacted the Cyrus folks, and they were my second case of wine that I sold. I think my mom bought the rest of the 75 cases, so it was I didn't have much of a mailing list, you know, at the time. But it was very scary. But I did kind of dip my toe in. I wasn't planting 30-acre vineyards. I was planting 3-acre vineyards. I was. You know, much like the vineyards in Burgundy, they were very small acreage and they were special hillside and ridgetop vineyards. They were not, you know, just run-of-the-mill average vineyards near, you know, rivers and creeks were with vigorous soils. They were knoll tops and hillsides and east-facing slopes and small acreage and coastal hills. And so we feel so richly blessed that the Dutton family and, you know, so many people believed in us. They thought we were crazy at the same time. You know, what are you planting these tomato plantations for? What are you, you know, why are you subjecting yourself to this torture? You know, I heard these comments all the time. I had a PhD viticulturalist tell me, you'll never get the fruit ripe. You know, and so then I put panels of 4-foot by 8-foot sheets of plywood up on, you know, at different fruiting wire heights. And I would go out every half an hour and I would take a Sharpie and I would map the amount of sunlight. And then I was like, well, wait a minute, if they ripen in Burgundy and Burgundy's, you know, farther north and they have a shorter growing season, why can't I ripen in California on this spacing? But this is a PhD telling me, I don't have a PhD. I'm just using logic. Like the geometry, the logic doesn't work, Dr. Science. You know, this doesn't make sense. So I had a lot of questions going through my mind and picking my fruiting wire height. You know, Burgundy needs radiant heat off of the vineyard floor, and I didn't want radiant heat. I saw radiant heat at Opus from their plantings, kind of making the fruit maybe a little overripe for my personal palate. It wasn't as fresh and as bright as I would like to see it. So I started sticking data loggers on a wooden pole and measuring where was there no longer radiant heat off of the vineyard floor, but that gave you the smallest trunk you could possibly have to reduce the carbohydrate storage in the vine so you could reduce the vigor of the vine. And it turned out 24 inches was that answer, that the fruit wasn't getting radiant heat off of the vineyard floor, but you had the smallest trunk. So I put a lot of thought and energy and time into researching and going to Italy and going to France and writing letters to Domaine Romani Conti and saying, can I come and prune with you and learn from you, and getting accepted into their vineyards. And because they were curious that I was doing something nobody else was doing in the US at the time. And all of this with no budget. I mean, I remember buying my wife and my first plane ticket to go visit Romani Conti in 2003. And it was like, wow, you know, this is $1,500 round trip. And that was a lot of money to us to go. And so we never tasted wine at Romani Conti because we knew we couldn't afford to buy the wine. But we wanted to learn from their vineyards so that we could, you know, try to figure out what viticulturally, I guess that's another question. Wow, there's so many things. Talking about 26 years in such a brief time, I feel like I'm jumping all over the place, and I apologize for that.
No, not at all.
One of the biggest questions that I had when I tasted that Romani Conti wine was, this wine is in such a different league than anything I've ever tasted before. What is it that we could possibly try doing in California to raise the bar that we are not currently doing? Yeah. And I started thinking through everything. Well, everyone's using French oak barrels for Chardonnay and Pinot Noir. Everyone has brought the plant material. We had the suitcase cuttings, but not only that, the Dijon selections were being brought in by Ontav in cooperation with UC Davis. So the plant material was in California, so that wasn't going to be the answer. Vinification techniques. People like Ted Lemon at Literai had gone there and actually made wine in Burgundy and brought fermentation science back. Fermentation science was kind of discovered. So what I felt we had the greatest room for exploration was in the vineyard world. That planting density, reducing the yield per vine, finding soils that were the most kind of restrictive or low vigor for these varieties, dry farming instead of irrigation. A lot of dry farming happened many years ago, but in the 90s when we started replanting post phylloxera, almost everybody was irrigating, and I feel irrigation kind of gives you a regional sense of wine, but not a vineyard specific sense of wine. So dry farming, the wine, the Chardonnay we're trying now is 100% dry farmed fruit. So you get a better sense of where these grapes are grown when you don't irrigate whatsoever. So these were the things that I started saying, this is the area we have to pay attention. If we ever want to compete in this league of what Romani Conti is doing, we have to pay attention to this level of detail. The reason that the French government developed the controlling body, the governing body for vineyards in Burgundy, was to improve wine quality. We don't need more of mediocre wine, was kind of the statement. We need to make less of the best wine that can be made. And they saw wine quality dropping when post-World War II, and so then they started in the 1940s and 50s really implementing procedures that they governed. How many buds can you have on a vine, regulating the yield, controlling hectoliters per hectare, determining what your minimum planting density could be of meter by meter. You can plant higher density than that. You can't plant less vines than that. All of these things were intended to make better wine. Doesn't mean that they always make better wine. It's 85% of the time it probably does. 15% of the time, if you could make other decisions, you might make better wine. But they were intended to make better wine. I have the freedom in California. I have nobody telling me what I legally can or can't do, but I have the freedom to study and research and design my vineyard farming practices in a way that I think in any given year is going to make the best wine. So I have more freedom in California, but I am implementing many of these Grand Cru standards that Burgundy is governed by, because I think they're relevant for making the best expression to wine. And every time I say something like that, I think of something new. I think of reading the Oxford Companion to Wine from cover to cover at John Ash & Company, and reading this. It's like an encyclopedia, right? So it's all alphabetical. You read it from cover to cover. You get to Pinot Noir, and you read Pinot Noir, the most yield-specific variety in the world. So what does that mean? What is yield specific? It means that it is the variety that when overcropped expresses the flaw the most of than any other variety in the world. So farming it to balance, getting the fruit in balance to the canopy and the soils and their capacity is more important with Pinot Noir than any other variety in the world. So that stuck in my mind. That was a little piece of information that I said, oh, okay. So then, you know, how do we get the lowest yield per plant, but not just dropping fruit, but actually getting the plant physically small enough so that when you prune in January, you're setting a small quantity of fruit by the number of buds you have on the vine, and actually hardly dropping any fruit on the ground, but actually having the vine in balance with very little fruit on it from the beginning. So that was a whole different aspect of thinking. Many people talk about dropping a lot of fruit on the ground. Oh, I had to commit mayhem. We dropped half the crop on the... Well, the vine's already ripened. The fruit in August when you're dropping fruit, or late July, I mean, set the fruit quantity in January when you prune and have the vine be in balance then. That's kind of where the best wine is getting. So these were all things that France was light years ahead of us on in viticultural practices, that I started focusing on studying those. So that's where I started 20 years ago. I didn't start by buying fruit and making wine. I started by planting the vineyards I wanted to make wine from, letting those vineyards develop, honing my craft as a vineyard owner. Then I started leasing vineyards back that I had planted in the style I wanted to make wine from. And then I had to figure out how to treat the fruit in the cellar. So then I started honing that craft. And it was about 2013. Well, 2011 was really the first wine that was in pure harmony, where I had no acid additions, I had no manipulations, wow, this wine really expresses what I want. And 2013 was the next vintage where I said, wow, I think I've actually got a lot to learn, but I understand enough that I want to increase my production over 1,000 cases and start sharing the wine with the world a little more commercially. Getting more distributors, going to more restaurants, that I felt like I had learned enough that I wanted to share. So I was very timid in my approach. I really wanted to learn to a level where I was very happy with sharing a glass of wine, and I had nothing to be afraid of, that I felt like my mission was being expressed in the wines I was sharing with 11 Madison Park in New York, you know, the best restaurant in the world. When I walk in there and share my wines, my conversation is as equals, as peers, that I'm dealing with the top level sommeliers in the world, but they're talking to me, they're tasting my wine as if my wines are worthy of their restaurant. And I didn't know if they were prior to 2013. So it's been fun to feel that level, like I feel my wines have now expressed the vision that I had when I first started this. And
I'm utterly fascinated by the vision and the fact that very early on, you actually ask yourself a really important question, which is what you were describing. You know, we have the cuttings, you know, we have the French oak and such like that, but that's not what's gonna get it done. You asked yourself a seminal question, how am I gonna get it done? And I think that framed the conversation in your mind and created that mental shift. It's not that you're trying to replicate Romani Conti, but you're trying to create something very special that's consistent with your vision. And when you use the word mission, it just kept popping up in my head. You were a man in the mission. You were someone that was destined to solve what I think everyone is aspiring to. Everybody says they want to make good wine, or the best wine, or the most delicious, most approachable, all those words out there. But you actually got behind your own rhetoric, and you're so far ahead in your thinking than anybody else, because you recognize what is it that you wanted and that there's a pathway to get there. And your pathway was very intentional. It was very deliberate. You cross-pollinated all kinds of sources, both working on the ground, but also, you know, talking to all these wise folks and getting their wisdom and watching what they're doing that wasn't working for you. is a tremendous network of various things that you've galvanized, that you mobilized almost to get to that goal. And you didn't put a timeline on it. And you're very modest, you know, obviously hold yourself to a very high standard, because you just shared with us that only in 2013 did you feel that this was good enough in your own mind. Even though so many people probably have told you along the way, I'm sure I was one of those people, that your wines are beautiful. But it wasn't quite there. So the fact that you're so motivated by all the right things is remarkable.
I really feel like I've had some of the best mentors in the world. And, you know, I don't think that as a producer of wine and a vigneron, that study and research and a quest for excellence ever stops. It's, if it does, then go trade stocks for a living or do something else. You know, if the research, the science, the quest for learning and sharing with other people and listening, asking questions when you visit other people, if that stops, then the wines, in my opinion, my wines will just kind of stay, okay, here they are, they're good, but they just kind of stay there. They're stuck. So, you know, it's mentorship, it's growth, it's questions, it's realizing I have more questions than I have answers, that are going to continue to help me evolve, the wines evolve, and hopefully my children will have that quest to do things I've never done. Go vinify wine in France. I've never made wine in France. I've been in November to help prune several times. I've been in Northern Italy, and I've been in Switzerland, and Champagne, but maybe they'll have the opportunity to go over there and make wine with some of the best. Maybe they'll get to farm and make wine at Romani Conti or Dujac or, you know, Henri Gouges or Australia or New Zealand, and bring new ideas to the table that I haven't had the chance or the capacity to think of yet. And that will be the voice of what continues to resonate with, you know, there are so many different ways to approach this industry. And, you know, I know that the experience that I had growing up on a 250 acre ranch, thanks to my grandparents and my family, really put me into a connection of studying from a very real perspective. For me, quite honestly, college and studying viticulture, although I learned a tremendous amount, I didn't learn quickly enough. I was so impatient. I needed more. I was visiting wineries, I was reading books on my own, and I was questioning everything that the instructor was saying. But what about this? They do it this way in other parts of the world. Well, this is California. Yeah, but is anybody doing this? I had so many questions, and then I started applying science to it, and it's been a lot of fun. It's been a lot of fun to
My core values, and arguably I probably value it, let's say it's in the top three, I was going to say I value the most, but it's critical thinking. And everything you just described speaks to that. That every curious mind, that not settling for it's just because, and digging for answers, I think that's what got you to a place like you described, very unique in terms, you know, in a physical sense, but culturally what you're doing is unprecedented. And to extend that you're doing is unprecedented. And I hope that everyone that's listening to this podcast goes to your website and orders a bottle of your wine. And I'm not saying this for marketing purposes. I'm saying it because you guys need to taste for yourself what that could mean when somebody puts that much heart and soul and intent and just never resting mind and heart to work. I think that's a culmination of all those things, and I think it's so darn interesting that you must experience it for yourself. And I'm so excited. We're about to move into the tasting segment. It's a rare treat. We're going to taste a vertical, your Chardonnay and Pinot Noir, and you're going to tell us a bit about the vintage variation and, you know, what the seminal points are of both the vintage and what your intent was, both in the vineyard and the cellar. So really excited about that. But I just want to highlight once again what a privilege it is to sit down with somebody that doesn't take things as gospel and learn for themselves and applies their knowledge. And I was going to ask you a question about the future, but you've already answered it. I know that you're a perpetual learner, and I certainly hope your children pick up the craft. As you mentioned, it's a generational affair, and you created so much value that it could be developed exponentially. So if they don't, I'm going to have to come over and talk to them about that, because it's a selfish reason. I want to see what happens.
Well, I need to thank you, Ilana, for coming out and sharing your time here at our winery and giving us the opportunity to tell a bit of our story. I will continue my critical thinking, but I'd also like to invite you back at any time to our tasting room, or any of your listeners, to reach out to us and come and visit the winery. We love to share, you know, wine and stories and our hospitality here at the winery.
The conclusion of this interview can be found in the next podcast, already available for your download. Thanks again for tuning in to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson.